This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Today we'll listen back to an interview about science, ethics, class, and race. One of the obstacles that used to face medical researchers was the difficulty of finding human cells that would keep multiplying in the culture of a petri dish. That problem was solved in 1951, when one doctor took cells from the cervix of a poor African-American woman who was dying of cervical cancer. For some reason, her cells were unique. They multiplied and multiplied and have been used in tens of thousands of research studies. They were essential in developing the Salk polio vaccine, as well as drugs for treating herpes, leukemia, influenza, and Parkinson's disease. They even went up in the first space missions so scientists could study the impact of zero gravity on human cells. This line of immortal cells that have contributed so much to science is called HeLa cells, named after Henrietta Lacks, the woman from whom the original cells were taken, without her knowledge. The HE in HeLa is for Henrietta, the LA is for Lacks. It took 25 years for her family to find out about HeLa cells. Her daughter Deborah wondered, if our mother's cells have done so much for medicine, how come her family can't afford to see a doctor? Last year, Terry spoke to science writer Rebecca Skloot. Her book about this remarkable story, The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, is now out in paperback.
Rebecca Skloot, welcome to Fresh Air. What makes Henrietta Lacks' cells, the HeLa cells, so special, so different from other cells?
It's sort of a mystery, in a sense. There are a few things we know for sure about them. I mean, one of them is that they were the first immortal human cell line ever to grow in culture. Scientists put them in culture in 1951, and they just never died. They kept growing and growing and growing. And scientists had been trying to do that for decades, and it had never worked. She had, when she went to the hospital, she had a tumor on her cervix that was about the size of a dime. And within 6 months, nearly every organ in her body was taken over by tumors. So her cancer grew incredibly fast in her body. When scientists put them in culture, they just took off. They doubled every 24 hours, and they sort of piled on top of each other and grew in this enormous sort of quantities that no cells had ever done before.
So the cells that the doctors took that have reproduced so much and have been used in so much research, those were her cancerous cells that they took?
Yes. Yeah, they took both. They took a small sample of her tumor without her knowing, and they took a small sample of her normal tissue. And this was part of a larger study. So to sort of putting it into historic context, in 1951, when she went to the hospital, the pap smear had just recently been invented. Very large numbers of women were dying of cervical cancer. And the pap smear had reduced those numbers a bit, but no one really knew exactly how to diagnose cervical cancer yet. So doctors would do a pap smear, and sometimes they would look at it and say, oh, that's just, it's a bacterial infection, and they'd give a woman antibiotics when she actually had cancer. Other times they'd look at it and say, oh, that's cancer, and give a woman, you know, do a hysterectomy on a woman who actually only had an infection. So this doctor at Hopkins decided that if he could just grow cervical cancer cells and normal cervical cells in culture, you could look at them under the microscope and establish this is what a cancer cell looks like, this is what, you know, a normal cell looks like, and it would help figure out this diagnosis issue. So he took samples from her normal tissue and from her tumor, and the normal ones died very quickly in culture. They never really went anywhere. So it was the cancerous cells that really took off.
Well, it's amazing that they can use cancer cells for medical research, since cancer cells are so different from healthy cells. So is that a problem for the research? How can they use cancer cells?
No, it's you know, there are things that are completely abnormal about HeLa because they're cancer. But there are a lot of things that cancer cells do that normal cells do. You know, they metabolize, they create energy, they get infected by viruses. So there's a lot that is that you can study that applies to all cells using cancer cells. The other big thing is that they're used almost like factories. You can infect them with a virus or various other things that you want to produce, and they'll grow those viruses in large quantities. And they're also sort of, they're like a baseline. They're almost treated like the white lab mouse or the fruit fly. Part of why they're so useful is that they just grow in these massive quantities.
Henrietta Lacks, her story is so interesting. I love the way you balance the personal story and the science story in your book. Henrietta Lacks was a poor African-American woman who in 1951, when she had cervical cancer, she'd never heard the words biopsy or cervix before. And I was kind of shocked to read a little bit about her medical story. First of all, at Johns Hopkins University, where she was in the colored ward. There was a colored ward in 1951.
Oh, yeah.
And another thing I found kind of shocking was the radiation treatment that she got. And I want you to describe that treatment.
Yeah. The treatment was a standard for the day, regardless of where you went for your treatment, pretty much, was that the doctors would take tubes of radioactive material called radium and literally sew the tubes to the surface of the cervix. They would put them in little pouches. And at first they would stick a few tubes up inside the cervix, and then they would sew the pouches full of these tubes to the outside, and they would leave them there for a few days, just sort of emitting radioactive material inside of you. And, this is the kind of stuff where it's the radioactive material that glows. It's that kind of radioactive material. And so it would essentially burn off the cancer. And then they would remove the tubes and send you home.
Was this a standard procedure then, or is this considered experimental?
Absolutely standard. And this is one of the interesting things. It's sort of an important point in the history of Henrietta Lacks. Her story has often been held up as one of, these sort of, awful white doctors who did these really kind of vicious treatments to her and stole her cells without telling her because they knew they'd be valuable. And that really wasn't the case at all. They were taking cervical cancer tissues from any woman who walked into Hopkins with cervical cancer. And this was absolutely the standard treatment. And in fact, it was considered the sort of top of the line. But, there are other questions about, this was a colored ward. This was the Jim Crow era. The reason she was at Hopkins in the first place was because she was black and there were not really many other hospitals around where she could have gotten treated. She also had no money, and Hopkins was a charity hospital. So she was in the public wards. And, there have been plenty of studies that have looked at how segregation affected healthcare delivery. So she did get the standard care of the day, but she was definitely sent home many times after her radiation treatment. She came back complaining of various pains and was sent home and sent home and sent home until she eventually refused to go home and said, no, put me in the hospital. And at that point, her cancer had spread so much. And there probably wasn't anything the doctors could have done either way. But, the question of how race played into her health care is a hard one to answer.
So you were able to tell this story about Henrietta Lacks, her cancer, her cells, how her cells were used scientifically, in part because you met members of the family. Once you decided that you were fascinated by the story, you tracked down the Lacks family. Of course, Henrietta Lacks was dead, but her daughter, Deborah, was alive. So how did you make contact with Deborah? And how old was she when you did?
She was in her early 50s when I finally got in touch with her. And she was very hard to find, and I realized later because she didn't want to be found. But I eventually tracked down a scientist who had her contact information, essentially. And he was the only scientist at that point who had done anything to sort of thank the family for the HeLa cells. He had organized a conference in Henrietta's name. So he essentially grilled me for about 3 days over the phone just to find out what my intentions were and to basically see if I was someone he was willing to put in touch with the family.
As opposed to what? Were they used to people getting in touch with them for questionable reasons?
Yeah. Well, I didn't know it at the time, but I came along in the 90s, and at that point, I was just another of a very long line of white people coming who wanted something having to do with the cells. So scientists coming saying, we want to take samples from you to do research to learn more about the cells. Journalists coming and wanting to, essentially tell the same story over and over and over again. And the reason why it was so upsetting for the family is because no one ever told them anything. The first time the family heard about the cells was 25 years after she died. And the way they learned about it was essentially a scientist called them wanting to do research on the family to learn more about the HeLa cells. This was the very early days of gene mapping, and they thought if they could take some samples from her kids, they could use their genes to study HeLa cells more. Henrietta's husband had a third grade education. He didn't know what a cell was. And he got this phone call one day, and the way he understood it was essentially, we've got your wife. She's alive in the laboratory. We've been doing research on her for the last 25 years. And now we have to test your kids to see if they have cancer, which wasn't what the scientist said. But, you know, the scientist said, we need to look at your HLA markers and your this and your that. And he had no idea what the science was. He actually, you know, to him, the only cell he'd ever heard of was the, you know, the kind in the jail where one of his sons was at that point. And Deborah was in her 20s, and she had feared her 30th birthday her entire life because she knew her mother died at 30, in her 30s, or she was diagnosed at 30, died at 31. So she knew her mother died right around 30, and she figured the same thing would happen to her. No one had told her why her mom died. So it made perfect sense for doctors to be calling saying, it's time to test you for this thing that killed your mother. So the family got sucked into this world of research that they didn't understand, and it was all pretty terrifying for Deborah. She didn't know if this stuff that they were doing hurt her mother. You know, they would say things like, we sent this stuff to the moon, and she would think, like, it, you know, was that okay for her mom? And when they injected them with chemicals and radiation, she was very worried that this was doing something very damaging to her mother's, either her mother's spirit or actually her mother might feel the pain of this stuff. So there was a lot of fear surrounding that.
So were you in a position to explain to Deborah what this was about once you found out?
Yeah, eventually. I mean, you know, Deborah, the one thing I got from our first phone call was that she was desperate to know who her mother was. Deborah was 2 when her mom died, so she had no memory of her and had spent a lot of her life really fixated on wanting to understand her mother's story. And, you know, did she like to dance? And what was her favorite color? And, you know, she grew up with a lot of men. She was very badly abused. And she held up her mother as this person who could have saved her. And so I knew that she really wanted to know about her mother. So I would go, and as I learned stories about her mother by interviewing distant relatives and finding the people she grew up with, I would call and leave messages on Deborah's voicemail saying, you know, hey, I talked to your, you know, cousin Cliff, and he told me this great story about your mom, you know, and they used to do this. And so eventually she called me and said, okay, fine, I'll talk to you, but, you know, only if you don't hide anything from me. And I said, hey, you can come with me if you want on my research trips. I will share with you everything I learn. I'm not trying to hide anything from you. So then, you know, she really did learn about the cells as we were going, you know, as we were doing this research. We'd go into labs and scientists would explain to her, you know, the basics of the cells. So she really did eventually learn about it.
Let's get back to Henrietta Lacks, who had a body riddled with cancer, and her cancer cells have been reproduced by scientists, and those cells have been used in so much medical research for decades. It's quite ironic that ironic isn't exactly the word. The family didn't find out about this until 25 years later. And the family is in a position where they can't always afford to go to a doctor. Some of them have, correct me if I'm wrong, some of them have health insurance, some of them don't. They've never seen a penny. They've gotten very little recognition for what their mother contributed. Legally, are they owed anything now?
Legally, no. In part because it's not clear who would owe them anything. You know, the cells were grown at Hopkins by George Guy, who then gave them to everyone who wanted them for free. He just gave them out because this was this unbelievably exciting development in research. He's like, here, everybody, do great things with these. And then it was down the road, you know, someone started at the first company that's, you know, this was the first company to ever sell a human tissues or human cells. So somebody started a company selling them because scientists wanted, you know, needed that. And that led to, multi-billion dollar corporations now. So it's impossible to calculate how much money has been made off of them. But no, they're historically speaking, there have been other cases where people have found out, hey, someone's using my tissues for research, and they've made, you know, in one case, a scientist patented someone's cells and sold licensed the patent for millions of dollars, and the man sued, and the court said, no, people don't have the right to profit off their body because the fear is that it would interfere with science.
Meanwhile, getting back to the HeLa cells, the cells that reproduce so well that so many scientists have used for research, the cells from Henrietta Lacks, the HE for Henrietta, the LA and HeLa from Lacks, these cells are now actually contaminating a lot of experiments. What's gone wrong?
Yeah, well, this started in the beginning, and no one knew it. So, when scientists first grew HeLa cells, when George Guy first grew HeLa cells, people thought he had just discovered the recipe and the sort of formula for doing it. And so everyone started taking samples from themselves and their kids and their patients and really quickly created this huge library of samples, which was being used in all sorts of important research. And in the 60s, at some point, one scientist basically realized these were pretty much all HeLa cells. And this was an enormous shock to the field. This was a big controversy. It meant potentially, you know, some people were potentially fabricating data, and there was millions of wasted research dollars. And the thing is that HeLa cells can float on dust particles in the air. They can travel on unwashed hands. You know, if you use a pipette to suck cells out of one dish and put them in another, and then you reuse that, you can transfer HeLa cells other places. And because HeLa cells are so hardy, they will essentially outgrow any cell that they encounter, and the other cell will die because it can't keep up, and HeLa cells take over. So what, you know, scientists thought they had all of these samples and, you know, this, and it all turned out to be HeLa. And, you know, it started this decades-long quest to try and, from a few scientists trying to clean up the contamination problem. And it's still happening. I mean, HeLa cells are still contaminating cell lines all over the place.
Your father, in 1988, had a viral infection that caused brain damage, and it immobilized him. He was in a clinical trial after this viral infection. And since this relates so well to the subject that you've been writing about, except it's much closer to your life history, what was the study that your father was involved in, and did he even know he was in a study?
Yeah, he did. He volunteered for the study. So he got this viral infection that caused this brain damage. No one knew what was really wrong with him at that point. There was the late 80s, so people were like, maybe this is some strange form of AIDS we haven't seen, or maybe it's cancer. And they were throwing around all these scary diagnoses. And eventually he got lumped under the umbrella of chronic fatigue syndrome, which was at that point where they were putting everyone that they couldn't really explain what was wrong with them. You know, he seems, you know, he can't move. He's got chronic fatigue syndrome. So there was this study that was looking at this particular drug to see if it would help people with, quote unquote, chronic fatigue syndrome. So he enrolled in it, and there were a lot of sort of ethical questions about it in the end. And, you know, I was 16. I had just gotten my driver's license, and he was unable to drive because of his brain damage. So I would drive him several times a week to this hospital where he'd get these infusions of either a placebo or the drug. And I would just sort of hang out and watch him and these other patients being used in the study. And at the time, you know, it was this incredible lesson for me as a kid, and I don't even think I realized I was learning it at the time, of like the hope of science and, you know, really thinking this thing was going to fix my dad. You know, he went from a marathon runner to being this guy who couldn't move almost overnight. And that was the same year I first learned about the HeLa cells. So I was 16 and in this basic biology class, and my teacher, you know, as all biology teachers do, at some point they say, oh, these are the first human cells, immortal cells ever grown in culture, and they're still alive today, even though she died in 51. Like, people learn the basics of this in biology. And for some reason, my teacher knew her name. He said, you know, her name was Henrietta Lacks, and she was black. So I, you know, immediately went up after class and asked my teacher, so, you know, what do they know about her? Tell me more. And he just was like, sorry, that's it. That's all there is. And that sort of planted the seed that, you know, all these years later became my book.
With your father's story, like watching him from the age of 16 have this mysterious disability that radically transformed his life, and then watching him slowly try to put the pieces back together to the extent that he was capable of doing that, how did that affect your sense of the vulnerability and the resilience of the human body?
Oh, I'm sure it affected it a lot, probably more than I ever have really thought about. And I think part of it also gave me a different appreciation for just illness in general and what a transformative experience it can be internally and sort of emotionally. And he's a very different person now than he was before he got sick. You know, and a lot of people say this happens to people often when they go through really, you know, difficult illnesses. He's a much warmer guy. He's a much happier guy. He realized how important, you know, people in his life are and things. So I think that more than anything, that's something I got out of it, is how transformative it can be to sort of fight through something like that. You know, and I saw that with Deborah. I mean, you know, Deborah, watching her go through this sort of arc of learning about her mother and the traumas of all of that, and then coming out the other side was so inspiring. I mean, she's the strongest woman I've ever met in my life. You know, she had no education really, and she had a very difficult time reading. So everywhere we'd go, she'd carry this little tattered dictionary around with her and look up words that scientists said to try to follow what was going on. I mean, she so badly wanted to learn things that, it was really inspiring to watch. And then, you know, she did come out the other side eventually feeling very differently about the cells and really embracing the great things that they did for science. And, you know, so the transformation that trauma can cause is really amazing.
This might seem a little arcane to people, you know, whether this woman's cells should have been paid for or what kind of acknowledgement she should get. But you point out in your book, we all have cells that are stored someplace. I never really thought of it that way, but is that true? We all have cells that are stored someplace?
Pretty much. It's hard to say everybody does. But yeah, the majority of Americans at this point certainly have, very likely have their tissues on file somewhere.
How? Like why?
Well, so there are a lot of different ways that this happens, and one of them is through, you go to the doctor and you get a biopsy. In a lot of cases, you know, you sign a consent form that says the doctor can dispose of this however, you know, he or she sees fit. Some cases it says can use this for educational research or research purposes, and that basically means they can take them and store them and do whatever they want with them. And in a lot of cases, so any child born in the U.S. since the 1960s, it's law that you have to all newborns have to be tested for genetic diseases. So everybody gets the little blood prick, and they test you for diseases, which is great. We need that. It's saved a lot of lives. But then those samples are often saved. So pretty much any child born since the 60s has their stuff on file somewhere. Circumcision samples are often saved.
Where is all this stored?
Oh, there are banks and banks and banks. I mean, there are so many different places. Some of them are for-profit. Some of them are non-profit. Some of them are in hospital basements. The range is really huge. Some of them are just these enormous factories, and the others is like some guy's basement, you know, with a bunch of vials in them.
You write in your introduction that while you were trying to make sense of the history of cell culture and the ethical debate surrounding the use of human tissues in research, you were accused of conspiracy, slammed into a wall both physically and metaphorically, and that you eventually found yourself on the receiving end of something that looked a lot like an exorcism. So choose the best story from those examples and tell us what happened.
There was actually a moment during the research process, and Deborah and I are traveling together and learning various things about the cells, where someone actually performed essentially like a faith healing, laying hands on her to remove the cells from her. You know, this sort of take the burden of these cells from this woman, Lord, she can't take it anymore. And I was, you know, the reporter sitting in the room with my notebook, just sort of scribbling notes going, oh, my God, I'd never seen anything like this. And, you know, they're screaming and praying and singing. And then all of a sudden, you know, he said, take these cells from this woman. And he turned to me and he put his hands on either side of my head and said, give them to her. And I just went, oh, you know. As a journalist, this is not something you necessarily expect. I'm not a religious person, and I'd never encountered anything like that. And it was such a powerful moment for so many reasons, which I'll leave to people to read in the book. But for me, that was actually the moment I knew I had to be in the story. I had been doing all this research for years, and I would come home from these research trips, and I would tell my friends and my family these stories, and they kept saying, "You have got to put this in the book because the family's reaction to you is the thing that illustrates how really damaged they've been by this. And how are you going to show this any other way?" And I was like, no, this is not my story. This is their story. I actually have issues with writers who put themselves in books where they don't belong. So I was like, no, it is not my story. And I just refused for years. My agent would harass me about it. And then that moment when he said, give them to her, I just went, oh, God, I have to be in the book. You know, and I mean, it wasn't like my first reaction, but that I realized in that moment that I had no choice because I had really become essentially a character in the book. and that I realized it would sort of be dishonest to leave myself out.
So did you or Deborah feel any different after this?
Oh, she was utterly transformed. Yeah. It was pretty incredible to watch. And not only was she really released from so much that was so much of the anxiety and fear that she was going through, but she was also completely transformed in her relationship towards me. You know, she didn't trust me. Even once she started talking to me, she was terrified that I was going to do something to her. She would have these moments where, for long periods, she was fine. And then she would have moments where she would think, maybe Johns Hopkins sent me, and I'm going to take her somewhere and take her cells. And, you know, she would have these kind of paranoid moments that, out of context, sound a little crazy. But when you look at them in the grand scheme of her life and think, okay, someone came to her at, you know, 25 years after her mother died and said, hey, part of your mother's still alive, and there's enough of it that if you put her cells end on end, they'd wrap around the earth three times. You know, they'd weigh more than 50 million metric tons. And that was true, you know. And so what's too strange? Her entire barometer for what sounded possible was just completely off kilter because of the things that were done with the cells. And so she would have these moments of utterly fearing me. I wasn't allowed to ride in her car. So we would go on these trips and take two cars and I would follow her. And after that moment, that everything changed in our relationship. That was the day she first let me get in her car. And so
why? Because part of her was now in you?
Yeah,
in her mind.
And yeah. Well, right. And I had, part of the cells was in me. And I think also because in that moment, one of the things that, you know, the person who was performing this faith healing, or laying on of hands, I guess, one of the things he kept saying is, you're not alone in this. She kept saying, I can't take this by myself. I can't do this. And he said, you know, you're not alone. And then he did that, you know, sort of transferring the cells to me. And I think part of it was realizing that, yeah, I was actually there and in this really long haul with her. You know, I mean, this book took 10 years to write. And, you know, I think that was the moment she realized I wasn't going anywhere for real. That I was maybe, you know, not going to hurt her.
So when the cells were, quote, transferred to you by the faith healer, did you feel anything transformative?
In some ways, yeah. I mean, this religious, you know, the faith and spiritual stuff in this story, it's pretty heavy. You know, her family really, some members of her family believe that Henrietta is the Lord's first immortal being, you know, chosen and brought back to life as these cells to cure diseases. And, you know, and she sometimes causes problems. You know, Deborah always said the whole contamination thing was Henrietta getting back at scientists. She's like, you know, you don't piss Henrietta off. She will sick HeLa cells on you. You know, she'll have them come and destroy your lab. But all of that was very hard for me to kind of wrap my head around initially. I was raised, I have no religious background at all in terms of that stuff. So, but it was transformative. In a lot of ways, what the thing that was building in me, which became even in some cases, in some way more powerful right then, was the weight of this story, the responsibility that I felt to tell this story and to get it right, to not, you know, to write it in a way that people will want to read and will get through and all of those things, and to just get it all out of my head and onto the page. I felt such a burden of that.
Since you raised so many ethical questions about medical research in the story and informed consent, were there any ethical questions that entered into your relationship with Henrietta Lacks's daughter, Deborah?
Oh, absolutely. And in a lot of ways, I think this book is just as much about journalism, you know, and the ethics of telling people's stories as it is about science. You know, there are so many questions about, you know, who has the right to tell your story? And do you own your own story? And, you know, there are a lot of questions about that. You know, one of the first questions that once Deborah's family agreed to talk to me, the first question they asked was, what are you going to pay us? You know, here you are, yet another white person who showed up at our house wanting to do something that you are going to potentially profit off of that we might get nothing out of. You know, at the time, I was in my 20s. I was paying for all my research using student loans and credit cards. And I was like, I don't even know if this thing's ever going to get published. And, you know, but I said to them, you know, and there is a code of ethics in journalism that says, you know, you don't pay people for their stories. It changes the relationship. It becomes a business partnership, not a sort of journalistic endeavor. And I felt like, you know, I felt like I couldn't pay them for their story. But at the same time, I didn't want to be another person who just sort of came along, got stuff from them and left. So what I told them in the beginning is if this thing ever actually happens, I'm going to create a foundation, a Henry Lacks Foundation that has a scholarship fund. And I will put some of my money into the scholarship fund from the book, and it will be open for any scientist, university, corporation, anybody in the world can donate to this thing. And it would be a scholarship fund that would help essentially educate any of the descendants of Henry L. Lacks and, others in similar situations. And I said this, I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I didn't know how you create a foundation or scholarship fund, but I did. I did it. And so the foundation actually just went live. And my hope is that, and Deborah was, this was something that was very important to Deborah. She came to realize as we were going through this whole book process that one of the biggest problems with in the story was that she didn't have an education. So she came to a point where she realized if she had just been able to, ask the right questions to the scientists, and if she had had a little more exposure to science, even on a basic level, she might not have been so scared and this stuff might not have been so traumatic for her. And she might have just been able to say at some point, hey, wait a minute, this isn't clear to me, and just to sort of be comfortable questioning things a bit more. So for her, one of the big important elements of this is, she wants the future Lacks generations to be educated. She does not want them to have to go through what she went through, carrying her dictionary around, trying to understand something so scary to her. And so I felt like that was what I could do for that. But then, there were a lot of other ethical issues that I sort of grapple with in the book about telling the story. And in the end, that's why I'm in it, because I felt like if I wasn't, then that would be journalistically unethical in a sense. I felt like I had to show the impact I had on this family, which, I put them in some pretty hard situations that had some pretty bad effects on Deborah in the moment. I think in the end it was all good for her, but, there were some pretty bad things happened. And so I felt like that all had to be in there as sort of just to be upfront about what was going on in the story and my role in it.
Rebecca Skloot, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rebecca Skloot is the author of The Immortal Life of Henrietta Lacks, which is now out in paperback. Terry spoke with Rebecca Skloot last year. Here's an update on the Henrietta Lacks Foundation. The foundation, which is funded in part by proceeds from the sales of the book, is now an established nonprofit organization. The foundation reports that to date it's given out 8 educational grants for Henrietta's grandchildren and great-grandchildren, in addition to grants for medical care for Henrietta's descendants. Deborah Lacks, the daughter of Henrietta Lacks, passed away in 2009 at the age of 59. And finally, Oprah Winfrey and Alan Ball are producing an HBO film version of Rebecca Skloot's book. They hope to be in production by the fall. Before saxophonist Stan Getz became famous for popularizing bossa nova with The Girl from Ipanema, and before recording the great jazz and strings album Focus in the early 60s, and then leading a hip electrified band with Chick Corea and Stanley Clarke, Getz recorded with small jazz groups all through the 50s. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new reissue of Getz quintet recordings. He says Getz was one of the best at playing pretty.
Stan Getz on Body and Soul, 1952, from the Clef and Norgran sessions on 3 CDs. When he recorded that at age 26, he'd been playing professionally for a decade, since joining trombonist Jack Teagarden, who taught him a lot about relaxation on or off the bandstand. Teagarden was an economical ballad player and extravagant drinker. Stan Getz became a star with Woody Herman's post-war orchestra. His gorgeous sound stuck out even in that great band. Like other young white tenor players, Getz emulated Count Basie star Lester Young, master of aloof improvisations that floated over a band. You can really hear his influence at quick tempos when Getz does his take on Young's pet move, writing one barely changing note. Lester Young wasn't always thrilled to have an ardent admirer more successful than he was. "Stan gets the money," he grumbled. But where Young cultivated a cool timbre like a foghorn in a fog, Getz's tone was luxurious. He had one of the most beautiful and recognizable tenor sounds in a music brimming with great saxophonists. Stan Getz said he tried to take the reed out of his sound and put his breath into it. His tone was soft but consistently strong all over the horn. One reason John Coltrane dug it. That and his way of obsessing over little phrases sometimes. The Stan Getz Clef and Norgran sessions include seven quintet dates made between 1952 and 55, with sidekicks including guitarist Jimmy Rainey and trombonist Bob Brookmeyer. There's also a quartet session with Jimmy Rolls on piano, but it's really Getz's show. He likes fast tunes too, but the ballads are the real grabbers. Getz had myriad ways to tease a standard melody, caressing each note and letting one impromptu phrase inspire the next. It gave his solos a sense of direction. He minds every moment, every detail. This is from Stars Fell on Alabama. Stan Getz the saxophonist is a master of poise and the poignant statement. Getz the man had a sitcom star's helping of booze and drug dramas and could be a little difficult. He was known to disparage the idea that his touching ballads concerned his own feelings. "Getting sentimental? I don't think about those things," he once said. Not that it matters. Watching a knockout screen performance, I don't worry what Meryl Streep was really thinking about that day. Stan Getz had an exquisite sound and played shapely variations on classic tunes and created bell-clear improvisations. Shouldn't that be enough? Thank you.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. His new book is Why Jazz? A Concise Guide. He reviewed the new reissue Stan Getz Quintets, the Clef and Norgren studio albums, on Verve. New Jersey-born Tom McCarthy is an actor you might remember from TV shows like Boston Public or as the overly ambitious newspaper reporter in the fifth season of The Wire. But he's also the writer and director of two acclaimed features, The Station Agent and The Visitor. His new film, Win-Win, is a feel-good comedy, starring Paul Giamatti as a down-on-his-luck lawyer who moonlights as a high school wrestling coach. Film critic David Edelstein has a review.
Few trajectories on film are as compelling as the journey from intense isolation to the embrace of a surrogate family, an arc that's Tom McCarthy's specialty. In his blessedly serene comedy, The Station Agent, the dwarf protagonist, played by Peter Dinklage, arrives in a small New Jersey town, silent and unsmiling, like Clint Eastwood shrunk down, and then begins to attract a band of outcasts who warm up his world. McCarthy's next film, The Visitor, featured Richard Jenkins as an emotionally closed-down economics professor who's thrown together with a bunch of illegal immigrants. And lo, he comes out of his shell and creates a new family. McCarthy's terrific new comedy, Win-Win, opens, of course, with a lonely loser. He's Mike Flaherty, played by Paul Giamatti, at his most likably schlubby, a suburban New Jersey attorney with two daughters, one an infant, who can't pay his bills and can't bring himself to tell the truth to his wife, Jackie, played by Amy Ryan. The first shot of him is from behind, on a jogging path, as he staggers to a halt and gets passed on either side by a pair of peppy runners. Moonlighting as a high school wrestling coach, he watches his scrawny, hapless team lose match after match. Mike is a heavy, haunted man, a heart attack waiting to happen. Then a way out presents itself. He can take $1,500 a month from a near-senile court-appointed client, Leo, played by Burt Young, under the pretense of acting as the old man's guardian. But now he's even more isolated. He's violated his professional and personal ethics. He is a lost soul. Relief arrives in the guise of disaster. Leo's emotionally damaged grandson, Kyle, played by Alex Schaefer, turns up at his grandfather's house, on the run from his druggy mom and her abusive boyfriend, and circumstances lead to his moving into the Flaherty's basement. At first, Mike's wife Jackie is scared of the kid, with his bleached hair and one black eye, an eerily flat demeanor. But when she hears about his past, she gets riled.
Not in the position to take care of another kid right now.
Well, I don't care. I'm not sending him back there. I can't. For the record, I'm not very happy about it.
Fine, then we don't have to do this.
Yes, we do, Mike. We do. Makes me so angry and so damn sad to see him in this situation. He's just a kid.
Yeah, I know. I know.
I want to go to Ohio and beat the crap out of his mom.
Okay, come on.
No, I do. I want to beat the crap out of her and her stupid boyfriend.
Okay.
I'm serious.
I know you are. I don't think that beating the crap out of everybody is the best solution, that's all.
It feels like it.
What I love about that scene is how the edge in Ryan's voice seems to cut through all the fatty resonance in Giamatti's and goad him into action. They're a perfect screen couple. And Win-Win is a symphony of marvelous voices, including Schaefer's. In his acting debut, he has a stoner drone that suggests a kid whose emotions are pushed way down. As luck, and of course McCarthy's slickness, has it, Kyle turns out to be an accomplished high school wrestler. As he joins Mike's team and turns the season around, we're blindsided, as in The Blind Side. But like that other indie winner, Little Miss Sunshine, Win-Win is a go-for-it movie with all kinds of dissonant notes. That's what saves it from being cloying. Before Kyle wrestles, he insists that Mike give him a hard slap across the face to, quote, wake him up. It's funny because Mike is such a gentle soul and can't believe what he's doing, and funnier when others on the team request a slapping, too. But the subtext is ghastly. It suggests that Kyle's wrestling talents are fueled by abuse. When his mother shows up, he leaps out windows to avoid her. Played by Melanie Lynskey, best known for her role opposite Kate Winslet in Heavenly Creatures, she has a breathy, seductive little voice with a touch of Marilyn Monroe, but a beady eye on the main chance. There's tension all through Win-Win. We fear that Mike will get caught for his financial fraud. Yet on some level, we want him to be caught, to own up for his soul's sake and the sake of the family that now includes Kyle. Is a win-win scenario even possible? The title gives you a hint.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can join us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at NPR Fresh Air. And you can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. Terry Gross returns Monday. I'm Dave Davies.